Now it's my turn to deflect, because I've never been great at accepting compliments unless I'm playing a part. Well, I hope you write that into your Oscar speech. I apologize to Tatum Connolly for being a tyrant and for making her do extra takes just for the hell of it. It was part of my job. I can see his eyes wrinkle into a grin underneath his muffler.
It was just some stupid short to fulfill my thesis. Romantica isn't winning any Oscars.
Well, not with that attitude, it's not.
All I want is some funding. Maybe expand it into a feature. Maybe get an agent with it. Oscars aren't exactly on my radar.
I thought you told me once that you promised your dad an Oscar. That was part of the deal.
He shrugs his puffy shoulders.
Did you not hear what Leo just said about my dad? Kind of impossible standards.
Well, my mom always says, if you can dream it, you can be it, I say. So why not dream it?
I don't add. She's sick again. She called a few days ago and broke the news because she didn't want to tell me when I was home for Christmas, but she told me not to worry, that it doesn't look so bad, that they caught it again before it spread too far. She hadn't betrayed a hint of it for the 3 days I'd been back. That was all the vacation time I could afford when I could pick up overtime work at the bar and jumpstart my bank account for the new year. She looked tired, sure, but she almost always looked tired from her shifts at the hospital. And on Christmas Eve, she and Piper and I curled up on the couch, like we did when Piper and I were little, and watched It's a Wonderful Life. And it never once occurred to me that the insidious seeds of cancer had returned. Tonight, on the last night of the year in the span of the millennium, I try to forget that my mom is sick again. That after her call, I thought the walls of my tiny student apartment might crater on top of me. But I am an actress. I can pretend to do anything, be anyone. So I compartmentalize my fear and reach for Ben's hand. I will tell him tomorrow, because I know on instinct that I can tell him, and he will find a way to make it a little better. For now, my glove finds his, and it feels right, it feels sturdy, like I'm holding on to something grounding. He says,
"You've always wanted to do this?"
Times Square? Oh my gosh, I grew up watching it with my sister every year.
No, he laughs. Acting, movies, theater, all of that.
Oh, it's the only thing I really ever felt like I was good at.
Besides bartending.
Besides that, yes, of course.
Because you're terrible at making bets.
Ugh. I groan loudly enough to be heard over Caroline and Leo, who are cheering at Boys to Men, who have just wrapped their set, beamed in on the large screens from Hollywood. I'm sorry, but that was fixed, stupid Daisy. He squeezes my hand through our gloves, and I squeeze back, like we have a secret code, like there is an electric pulse running through him, into me, and back again. And now there are only a few minutes until midnight, and the snow is both furious and beautiful, eye-opening and blinding, and we have given in to the excitement of the other thousands of people here, of Dick Clark's voice over the enormous speakers that surround the block, of the twinkling ball that's projected across the screens 100 feet above us.
"I'm glad you made me come here,"
he says, his breath billowing in a plume of white steam.
"I've lived here all my life, and I'd never have done this without you."
"I'm glad that Daisy got the chicken pox," I reply,
and his blue eyes widen, then crease into happiness.
"I'm glad that I didn't give you my number last year," he says. "My heart couldn't have taken it at the time."
"I'm glad that I didn't ransack your heart, and so you're not dead, and that dumb ex-girlfriend didn't have to revive you with her fancy medical knowledge, and then, either way, dead or alive, you wouldn't be here with me now."
He nods.
"I'm glad that I'm here with you now."
He peers toward the sky.
"God, it's like I'm seeing this city for the very first time."
He finds my eyes again.
"It's like I'm seeing a lot of things for the very first time."
The crowd has started cheering, counting down, jumping and throbbing and clamoring for midnight, the start of something new, the promise of beginnings.
"Me too," I say.
"I see you," he says.
"I see you too," I say. And I do, and he does, and it's as if he has a microscope inside of me.
And then we are at 3, and then we are at 2, and then we are at 1, and he is kissing me. Or maybe I am kissing him, but it doesn't matter, because the old year is behind us, and a new one lies in wait. And I don't worry about my mom, and I don't worry about my next part, or my next paycheck, or my mom's next scan. Thousands of pieces of sparkling confetti rain down, mixing with the snow, and I feel like I'm caught in time, caught in a perfect moment inside a snow globe that maybe I'd beg my mom for at a gas station, and I can't find my breath, and my knees feel a little wobbly, and I try to remind myself to remember this moment, to hold on to it forever, to seal it up like we really are in that snow globe, and to never let anything shatter the bubble that envelops us, that protects us from everything else around us in the outside world.
5. Ben. August 2014. Jesus. Somehow I turned 40. I'm turning 40. Tomorrow. I let the hot water from the shower pulse against my face and neck for too long. And by the time I flip the shower handle to off, my skin is pink and a little angry. I grab one of the white towels hanging on the pewter hooks and knot it around my waist. Then stare at the full-length mirror in the bathroom that is half-packed because we're moving next week. Tatum needs a house with better security. Tatum needs a house that moves us one more step toward isolation. We're stuck in this bubble that is entirely our creation, and it feels as if there's no way out, no room to breathe. I blame her for this. I run my hand over my stubble, meet my eyes in the mirror. It's an unkind thought, and I chastise myself for it. She loves this house, loves the family we built here, though now that family is tenuous at best. Though we are doing an excellent job at pretending that we're not falling apart. Both to each other and to the various media outlets who occasionally sniff at some unhappiness, but mostly paint her and us as something out of a blissful, stylized magazine spread. We both equally loved this home in Holmby Hills, that had seen us through so much. But a month ago, we'd woken up to her stalker staring at our family photographs on our living room fireplace mantle, and after she hid in the closet and I called the police, we both knew that the house was just another thing we had to let go of, like anonymity, like a normal life where we, she, kept sane hours and caught up on our days over dinner and grew a vegetable patch out back and greeted tiny trick-or-treaters come Halloween. None of that is who we are anymore, not with Tatum's fame and the bubble that it's forced us into. The new place in Brentwood has a 10-foot wall in a gated community, and is impenetrable, literally. A large Israeli man with a Bluetooth earpiece and a holster on his hip walked us through the security system and explained the ins and outs, explained how we were safer there than at the White House. I was dubious, but we'd only been to the White House once. Tatum was invited for a press dinner. I was literally patted down in my tux twice and screened through 4 metal detectors, but what did I know? We talked about getting a guard dog. Monster is old and slow, and besides, he'd befriend anyone who gave him a treat, threw him a literal bone. We talk about round-the-clock bodyguards, though I point out that the large Israeli man told us we were already safe. Hey, Tatum pops her head around the bathroom doorway. You almost ready, or are you too busy admiring yourself in the mirror? You're an old man now. Come on. I'm looking good for 40. I grin and suck in my stomach. Show her my profile. She sighs. Or not? I don't know. I let my stomach deflate.
No, you do. You are. I got my period. Maybe we're just too old.
You're not 40, just me, I remind her. We'd started trying for another child about 9 months ago. Last year, right around when Piper was pregnant. In fact, Tatum had sprung the news on me that she wanted another one when we were back in Ohio for Piper's baby shower. I figured it was the excitement and the nostalgia. The little onesies, the cute stuffed animals and music boxes. We'd always been fine with one, with Joey. We'd agreed on that. One. Tatum barely had time to fit Joey in her schedule, much less me. But she announced it with such authority and such conviction that I couldn't even question it.
I think we should have another baby, and I've already made time for it in my schedule, so I think it should work and let's just do it.
I'd just gotten home from a run through her old neighborhood. I remember peeling off my shirt and Tatum lingering in the bathroom as if she were issuing a press statement. We're going to have another baby. Not phrased as a question, not tossed out as a possibility. I started to say, you've already lost track of me. Will I be pushed out entirely when a new one comes along? But it felt needy and jealous, and a little childish, too. Also, I had the weight of my guilt sinking me down. All of the ways, both big and small, I betrayed her over the past 2 years. So I nodded, flipped on the shower, and said, okay. I was happy with one, with Joey. Tatum needed more. I took it personally, until I remembered that I'd needed something more, too, and Tatum had no idea. There are a lot of reasons that you say yes to something you don't really want. Guilt worked perfectly well for me. Besides, Leo had been everything to me. I could understand wanting to give Joey a sibling. We can try again next month, I say to her now, in the half-packed bathroom. Though the idea of rising with a screaming infant at 3 a.m. felt less palatable with every passing month. At 40, my own dad had a 15-year-old and an 8-year-old. He had the energy for us, but barely. A newborn? It sounds exhausting already. Don't worry, I repeat. We'll try again. I don't know when I stopped telling Tatum my truths. She used to read everything about me, see through me. Maybe I stopped telling her my truths as a challenge to see if she still could. I'm away next month. Vancouver, remember? I don't remember, but I say, oh, right. I don't ask why or what for. There's a giant master calendar in the kitchen that I can consult if I need to know where to find her on a certain day. Her assistant uses color coding to make it easier. Red for onset, blue for media, green for meetings, orange for Joey. I don't get a marker. It's assumed, I guess, that I can write in my own commitments to fit around hers. Actually, maybe that was when I stopped telling her my truths. When a giant master calendar went up and there wasn't a marker for me. Then the following month, I offer. She shrugs. Okay, hurry up. We have a reservation. Down in 10. When you're this good looking, it doesn't take much. I wink, try to make her laugh. Ha, she says on her way out the door. I reassess myself in the mirror. Though I don't want a newborn, I could manage. I am a younger 40 than my dad was at the same age, though he rose most mornings to play racquetball, out the door before our nanny had even made us breakfast. I'm a more involved father, too. A field trip in May to go berry picking. I was the only dad. Coaching peewee soccer last fall. Midnight trips into Joey's room when he has a bad dream. For my dad's 40th, we took a family trip to Paris. I remember it because he had just wrapped a monster trial, which meant that I saw him even less than usual. And my mom kept telling us, we'll all have time together on this trip. If she minded my dad's absence, she didn't complain. She doted on him when he was around, brought him tea, made his favorite dinners. When he wasn't, she was busy as the president of Dalton's PTA, as chair of one charity committee or the other. We flew to Paris first class, and Leo, still cute and impish at 8, charmed the flight attendants into giving him all the leftover chocolate. My dad spent most of the flight quizzing me on my French, I was in honors, and then reading briefs for work upon his return. But Leo, hopped up on all the chocolate, was nearly vibrating, and he scaled the seat and somersaulted into the lap of the Frenchman behind him, who was none too pleased, and then quickly turned irate when Leo knocked the man's coffee into his lap. My dad, who had just started wearing reading glasses, pushed them higher on his nose and said, then apologize in French to him. Make nice. Sort it out. My mom was asleep from her 2 glasses of wine. My dad's own French had been honed at Yale. He could speak it better than I could. And after all, he was the parent. But I did as I was asked. Partially because I wanted to impress him. Partially because it wasn't phrased as a question. Once I had apologized in mostly fluent French, and Leo had strapped back into his seat and had pulled out some crayons and a coloring book my mom had stowed in his backpack, my dad looked over from across the aisle and said, nice job, Ben, then returned to his briefs. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't such a life-altering incident. But it was profound in its own way. That my dad sent the message that I was Leo's keeper just as much as he was. That he also conveyed that I was the responsible son. That I was literally there to clean up Leo's messes. I resented my dad for that. I remember stewing over it, staring out the window somewhere over the Atlantic and thinking, why did I have to talk down that French guy who was shouting about sending enfants to the back of the plane, while you acted like your briefs were more important? But later in the trip, when we were touring the Louvre, I found myself showing off for my father, conversing with our tour guide as often as possible, asking questions I really didn't even care about, because I wanted my father to look over once more and say simply, nice work. I thought about that for a long time afterward. How complicated approval and resentment can be. How they can be tied together so closely that you might mistake one for the other, if you're not careful. My eyes falter in my bathroom mirror as my phone buzzes on the vanity counter.
Happy birthday tomorrow. I wanted to be the first to wish you.
Then another buzz.
Sorry, shit. I wish I hadn't sent that. You don't have to write me back. Or do, if you want.
Instinctively, I grab my phone and start typing until my brain tells my fingers to slow down. They're shaking with adrenaline, so I'd have to delete most of what I wrote anyway. I delete it all, rest my phone back on the marble, then swipe it back up and throw it into the bottom cabinet drawer. As if that can stop the temptation of starting back up with Amanda, when I've been so resolute since I cut things off last December, 8 months now. I ended it only when I found a draft of an email to Tatum's publicist asking how she would plan a strategy for divorce. We were trying for the baby, but Tatum had always been one to have a backup plan. I read the email to Luann.
How could you position this so people know I tried my hardest to make it work?
And something came undone in me. That while I'd been toying with Amanda, maybe seriously, but maybe not, Tatum was toying with a whole other life without me, too. Amanda had been an escape. Tatum, it turned out, had one, too. I'd closed out of her inbox and run to the bathroom and nearly shit myself. Literally. I'd been such a stupid, stupid fuck. I have to remind myself of this every time Amanda texts, every time Tatum is dismissive of me. Every time she doesn't even think to give me my own marker on our enormous calendar, or when she announces that we're going to try for another kid and doesn't expect to be challenged because she has a team of people who surround her now, wrap her in bubble wrap, to ensure that she is protected. But after the email calamity, I met Amanda in a Starbucks near Cedars. We have to stop doing this, I said simply. I'd rather cut off a limb, but I have to. Neither of us believe that to be true. It was raining that day, and her flame-red hair was matted and damp, and she reminded me of how Monster sometimes looks, like he still needed to be rescued even after we took him in all those years ago. But as she batted her eyes, fighting back tears, it occurred to me that I'd misplaced my own rescue operation, that I'd been reckless and gotten high off the thrill of us, but I was the one who actually needed to be saved. There is nostalgia for an ex. And there is crossing a line to entertain that nostalgia. That's not love. That's not worth risking your life over. Fuck. I'd screwed things up so badly. And it was all I could do to try to right myself, ourselves, before Tatum ever caught wind of it. It was the first time it had occurred to me, not in an impish, thrilling way, but a deep-in-my-guts way, that Tatum could find out and leave me. I'm sorry. I said. I'll miss you. I drove home, my windshield wipers flapping too quickly, and I realized I was no different from Walter, and his alcoholism and years of unkept promises, and no different from Leo, with all of his demons and screw-ups. We all have that shiny carrot we chase when we know it could be poisonous. We all step too close to the flame because we wonder how much it would hurt if we get burned. I'd felt forgotten, overlooked by my own wife, when loyalty was what I'd always wanted. And so I found a way to be seen, found a way to trump her passive disloyalty with my own. That doesn't make it forgivable. It doesn't mean I excuse it. But that's what it was, all the same. I reached for my phone from the bottom cabinet drawer. I knew it would do me no good, stuffing it there. Amanda had proven devoted, as if she'd learned a lesson from the years that separated us, and now she was mine, if I wanted her. It was more than that, of course, for me. It was the wistfulness, the pining for being young and unburdened, for a different partner, different breasts and legs and lips. She was an easy escape, a sure thing, when my wife was gone so often, returning home in mercurial moods, with mercurial haircuts, with mercurial wishes that I didn't often understand. Partially because I stopped asking, partially because she stopped telling me. I turned to the side and suck in my stomach again, watching it fall and rise in the mirror, amazed that this body of mine has been on this planet for 40 years now, aware of how lucky I am to be alive, how fucking miraculous it is that any of us gets to be here another day. I pick up my phone, set it down, pick it up again. It's okay, I type. I miss you too, but I still can't. All true. Ben! Tatum's voice reverberates up the stairwell, echoes through the now mostly empty rooms, primed and ready for the movers.
My dad's here.
Walter is babysitting. A concession that I've only recently grown comfortable with, but a small concession all the same. The first time I'd approved, agreed to let him stay home alone with Joey, Tatum had clutched my cheeks and kissed me, really kissed me. And God, it reminded me of how effervescent she was. Not just compared to Amanda, but compared to what I'd grown used to now that I no longer really saw her every day. Compared to what I'd taken for granted. Give me 3 minutes, I yell back to her, then scamper into my half-packed closet and retrieve a shirt from a suitcase. We're having dinner, just the two of us, for my birthday. We haven't been alone on a date since forever. Really, honestly, I can't even remember the last time we made this sort of time for each other. Tatum, because she was so busy, me, because I retreated to the writer's room for code emergency, rather than face the massive calendar in the kitchen when I couldn't literally even be penciled in. It was easier to order in Chinese food with Eric and the writing staff than sit home alone in a quiet house, surfing the cable channels, or sometimes porn, after Joey went down. Not unlike how I dumped Amanda before she could dump me all those years back, when she applied to the residencies 3,000 miles away. Now I just stay busy so Tatum doesn't notice that her life is so much bigger than mine. I fold my arms into the button-down, straighten up in front of the mirror, and meet my eyes again. I find the watch she gave me this morning, because she couldn't wait until tomorrow, and I'd laughed because impulse control was never her forte, from my top drawer. Snap it on my wrist and feel its unfamiliar but not unwelcome heft. Tomorrow, I tell myself, I will start writing something for Tatum. Something that will bring her back to me. Something that can make us whole again. After all the ways that life has sliced away tiny pieces of us. I want to be better. A better spouse, a more present husband, a more understanding partner. One who doesn't mind that she is lost for weeks on end in the mood of whatever role she is playing. One who doesn't begrudge her for the offers that pour in and take her away from me and from Joey. Offers that she could say no to, but does not. And of course, I want to make it up to her. For Amanda. And my overt betrayals. Though Tatum knows nothing of the tryst. I know how I failed her, and that's enough. I find a tie. I almost never wear a tie, but I'm turning 40 tomorrow, and a tie feels like the right way to commemorate it. Tatum will be in something gorgeous, and tonight I'd like to do right by her, be her equal. I knot it around my neck, run my fingers through my hair, and assess. I gaze at my reflection. Yes, tonight I'm her equal. Tatum used to tell me about how she and her mom collected snow globes, how they'd pull into a gas station or stop into the hospital gift shop and search for a new one, something unique to add to their collection. It's always perfect inside a snow globe, Tatum once said. I always wondered why, and how. Because what it really seems to me is that you are trapped, stuck there in that fantasy land. I wonder now if I can write something for her that isn't a bit like a snow globe. Magical, self-preserving romantic. I wonder, though, if staying in the bubble is really what's best. If that's what she wants. If that's what I want. And if we puncture it, if we'll still find a way to breathe.
6. Tatum. July 2001. It is too hot for a funeral. That is what I keep thinking. It is too hot for a funeral, and how am I expected to be burying my mom when it's 103 degrees and I can't think straight because of the heat? I am sweating and clammy and red-faced, and my hair is sticking to the back of my neck, and my skirt is flush against the backs of my thighs, and the sun is so bright I wonder if I might go blind. She wanted to be cremated, scattered in our garden. She told Piper as much when it became clear that this time the cancer was too furious to be beaten back. Just some of the gals from the hospital, you girls, and some cake afterward, okay? They hadn't told me it was as bad as it was until just a few days before she was gone. And June, with Ben, had been blissful. He had found the money to turn the Romantica short into a feature, and we'd celebrated his Tisch graduation with a real, if low-budget, shoot, spending the days tromping through Central Park with his small crew, his small cast, and me as his star, spending the evenings in his parents' sprawling uptown apartment. They were in Europe for June, so I could collapse in his childhood bed without shame, without the next morning embarrassment of sneaking out. In our earlier days of dating, we landed at my tiny apartment most nights, but its starkness compared to the luxury he'd grown up in was claustrophobic and a little horrifying. When Piper called and told me that time was running out, I felt as if I were watching the conversation like a film. I was there, but not really. Distant, but still engaged just enough. Maybe I hadn't been paying attention, or maybe I'd just been so lost in falling down the rabbit hole of this new life that Ben breathed into me, a nearly working actress, a woman worthy of being adored, that I hadn't wanted to believe the truth of Mom's diagnosis. He'd told me he'd loved me right before I left to say goodbye to her. We'd been together 6 months, and I already knew in how he looked at me, by how he touched me. But I wasn't brave enough to say it first. As I was packing, grabbing whatever I could find that would be appropriate to wear to your mother's funeral, he sat on the bed and said simply, "Hey, Tate, I love you." And then I stopped grabbing whatever I could find and climbed back into bed with him and proved to him that I loved him, too. Told him, too. I told a million boys along the way that I loved them. This might have been the first time I understood what that meant, and even more so, how it felt to be loved back, to be seen, with my insecurities, with my bruises, with my baggage. It wasn't a coincidence that I'd done my best work with him on Romantica. He was the first person who ever saw through me, but not because he wanted to expose me, but rather because I was willing to expose myself. And now I am standing under the light of 1,000 suns, and Piper is plunked down on a tree stump in our backyard, her shoulders trembling, her head low. She is weeping, and I need to move to comfort her, to place a reassuring palm on her back, because that's what older sisters do for their younger siblings when their mom has died. But I worry that if I move, I'll collapse, like I'm a pile of emotional dominoes, and a tiny reverberation will send it all to dirt on the ground where we are about to toss the fiery remains of my mother's broken body. Instead, Dot, my mother's best friend from nursing school and then the rest of her life, offers Piper a hand, pulls her to her feet and into a bear hug. Piper burrows into her shoulder and wails. The doorbell rings inside the house, which brings me to. "I'll get that," I say, right as Piper manages, "Leave it, don't." The heels of my shoes slide off from my sweat, and I ditch them by the patio glass door and rush through the hallway to the door. I realize how hasty I am as soon as I've swung the door open. Everyone we needed to be here already is. Well, not Ben, but I told him not to come. He is racing to get Romantica edited in time for film festival submissions, which I used as an excuse to tell him not to join me. But also, I didn't want him to see where I came from, didn't need him to know unequivocally that I didn't deserve him, even on my best days, even in our best life. My mother was a nurse, and my dad sold life insurance, but not well, and only when he was sober. It's not that I was ashamed, really, but it's not that I wasn't, either. Our house needed a paint job, and the carpet was left over from the 80s. Ben grew up on an entire floor on Park Avenue, with a nanny and a housekeeper, and two parents who vacationed in Europe for the month of June. And even though he loves me, and even though he sees me, part of me, plenty of me, was still self-conscious. What if he saw how vast the divide was between us and decided that even when I put on my very best face, morphed into whatever role he needed from me, it still wasn't enough? He wouldn't have been my first boyfriend to do that, and he was already miles ahead of them, handsomer, more successful, better lineage. If all the rest of them could dump me, could deem me not worthy, what's to stop Ben when he uncovers the blights of my past? So I sat on the edge of his bed in his perfect childhood bedroom with a signed Yankees poster from Reggie Jackson framed above his headboard, and I assured him that I didn't need him to come. It was a masterful performance, really, convincing enough that he didn't even second-guess me. He kissed my tear-stained cheeks and stripped my shirt off, and then the rest of my clothes, too, and afterward held me against him until I stopped shaking and fell into a fitful sleep that offered no rest. The doorbell chimes again as I wrap my sweaty palm around the knob and swing it open. "Shit," I think, as the bright light of day greets me. "Shit," I actually say aloud when I see my dad standing on the precipice.
"Tate,"
he says, his voice breaking. He is dressed in an ill-fitting brown suit with a loosely knotted tie. He's aged in the 2 years since I left the Canton outskirts, since I last saw him at my college graduation party, which my mom threw for me here, in this very house. They were separated, again, and he got drunk, again, and she calmly asked him to leave, and then he didn't, so I less calmly asked him to leave, and then he toppled my graduation cake onto the concrete of the back patio, where it smushed into a depressing pile of cooked egg and flour and green icing. Piper grabbed him by the elbow and called him a cab, and we all pretended that he hadn't just ruined the party like he had ruined a million things before. I'd gotten good at pretending by then. I graduated with honors from Ohio University, spent my summers in Summerstock, where I'd met Daisy, been accepted to Tisch on grants and scholarships. As Piper dragged him out, and just before he swiped a loose arm at the shelf with my mother's and my snow globe collection, sending glass and water and sparkles careening to the ground, I'd pressed my face into something of a blissful smile and made a passing joke about how my dad had celebrated a bit too much at getting his daughter out of the house. This was my mask, my act. I counted on both so easily that I wanted to make a career of it. "Who invited you?" I say to him today.
"Piper."
He flops his hands, which seem to want to reach for me, but don't move too far from his sides. He knows better by now.
"Piper!"
I shout over my shoulder to the back of the house.
"I've been sober for a year,"
he says. "Congratulations."
"That's the longest since..."
I wave a hand, cutting him off. I know it's the longest since high school. I don't need him to tell me. Like Piper and I didn't used to hang the moon around the times when he was clear and present, like we didn't shut the door to the bedroom we shared and turn up the radio and sing too loudly to drown out the times when he wasn't. He was never violent, never even particularly cruel, only destructive to himself and unreliable, which meant that the one thing a child needed, stability, was the one thing he could never provide. Some mornings, when my mom was sick, it meant he'd be too drunk to drive us to the school bus, and we'd end up walking the route to the stop, usually missing it, then trudging to school on foot. Some afternoons, it meant asking the neighbors if Piper and I could join them for dinner, because our fridge was empty, and Mom couldn't get out of bed, and Dad was nowhere to be found. Well, he surely could be found, at AJ's, his bar of choice, but it's not like we were going to go down there and force him home. "I'm here to bury Mom, to help Piper. I'm not here to deal with you," I say to him. The sun shifts from behind a cloud, and again it's too bright, blinding, melting.
I narrow my eyes, squeeze them shut, then blink them wider like this is all a mirage. But he's still there when I open them.
Dad,
Piper says from behind me, then brushes past me into his arms. He emits a sob that sounds so guttural, I literally step back into the hallway. We return to the garden, me unable to look at him.
I couldn't not include him, Tate, Piper whispers. He's our dad. He was her husband. He was here a lot these past few months.
I nod, pressing my lips tightly together so nothing slips out all regret. Piper was always more forgiving of him than I was. She doesn't remember when our mom was first diagnosed when I was 12, and Dad coped by blacking out on the couch and getting fired from his job. She doesn't remember walking around the strip mall, going from store to store, asking if someone could give me a job, finally being granted a kind reprieve by Ralph at the pharmacy, who let me work as a bag girl. She doesn't remember him forgetting to pick me up from choir practice 3 times in a week and how humiliated I was to slink back into school to ask Ms. Birdwell if I could use a phone to try to call him, or someone. He was sober again by the time I was 14, when my mother was in remission, then not when I was 15, and it stayed that way mostly until I graduated. I lived on campus at college, but was home enough to see the pattern of ruin he left. And my mom finally saw it, too. She kicked him out, but she wasn't much better at sticking to her word than he was, and so their home became a revolving door of forgiveness. It wasn't any surprise that Piper learned the same lesson. Come back to me, and I'll absolve you. Dot, my mom's oldest friend, asks for us to hold hands, to bow our heads in prayer that Mom is no longer in pain, that she isn't part of this physical world, that she is somewhere else, somewhere better. I don't know if I believe this. I don't know what I believe, really. But I dutifully drop my chin to my chest, and the sun is so very, very hot again, and I think of Ben and wish he were here, but I'm also so relieved that he isn't, that he isn't seeing this mess of a life I've left behind, that he can't see my weeping, which is now coming in waves, that he can't see my father, who is clutching Piper's elbow. I think of the last time I saw my mother. Jesus, it was Christmas, when we watched It's a Wonderful Life. She asked me if I was happy, as if I even knew what that meant. I said, I'm happy, but I'll be happier when I'm employed, you know, working as an actor. She replied, don't define yourself by that, sweetheart. Don't live a life marked by intangible achievements. That's not intangible, that's real. She smiled at something I didn't understand. You're always saying, if you can dream it, you can be it, I said. Well, that's true. She nodded. My mom had always been a writer. Well, she'd always been a nurse, but she'd also been a poet. Just for herself, she said. Just because I can. I want you to be anything you dream of. But mostly I want you to be happy. Those things aren't always the same, you know. But what if they are? I asked. That's why you're young. That's why you have the time to figure it all out, she said, before rising to go make herself some tea. I feel dizzy under the sun's rays and worry I might pass out. Dot asks us all to step forward, to scoop my mother's ashes and to send them out into the air, over the garden, over our home, back into the ground where they'll bloom again in the form of flowers and snap peas and, if we're lucky, perfect strawberries in later summer. I squeeze Piper's hand tighter, unsure if I can do this, really let her go. But then I remind myself that I can do anything, be anyone. That is what I dream. I slip outside my grief, morph myself into someone else, someone who isn't here burying her mother, and I release Piper's grip and go.
7. Ben. April 2013. I'm dreaming again, as I do so often now, have for the past year, since everything turned bleak. This time I know I am dreaming, and yet I can't pull myself out of it. This time, as it has been recently, it's Leo. Always Leo. Though it used to be my dad. Now it's a distorted version of something out of real life. That night on April Fool's Day when he ran away in seventh grade, when I was a senior in high school. He was pissed at my dad for something. In real life, it was that my dad threatened to pull him from the football team because his grades were so mediocre. For my dad, C's and B's. But in the dream, it's because my father drowned in the Atlantic Ocean off East Hampton Beach, and Leah was there, watching, unable to save him. So Leo ran, and unlike how it really happened, where we thought it was a prank until 1 a.m. rolled around and my mom started crying and my dad started cursing, and I finally found him at his friend Nate's apartment smoking cigarettes and skimming bourbon. In the dream, I'm unable to trace him. I run down the emptied, littered streets of Manhattan, at night, at day, at dawn, at sunset, and Leo is simply gone. I shout down alleys. I scream around corners, and it starts raining, then hailing, and I am stuck in the middle of Times Square, unable to find any trace of my brother at all. I startle awake, blinking too quickly, discombobulated in an unfamiliar bed, in an unfamiliar room. A hand is laid across my chest, and a voice says, "I'm here." And my brain loops for a moment until I realize it's Amanda, not Tatum. And that we have spent the night at a room at the Standard, after I'd emailed her, claiming we needed to end things, but agreeing to drinks all the same. One drink led to two drinks, and then to a full bottle, and soon enough we were checking into a room, peeling our clothes off, doing the things to each other that I swore I would no longer do. My guilt was too heavy. The fear of being caught was consuming me. A tabloid had a small headline about Tatum's unhappy marriage and my wandering eye last week. Tatum never paid that stuff any mind, barring the scathing rumors after the Oscars, which I couldn't even begin to contemplate because of Leo. In another universe, another time, maybe it would have cut more deeply. But it was all I could do to breathe back then, much less contemplate what her behavior represented. It represented something, I knew, though. That much wasn't lost on me, even in my haze of grief and confusion. And maybe, yes, it served as a subconscious excuse for what I did next, with Amanda, with my self-destruction. I don't know. But the headline about me, my affair, that one permeated. I'd been in the checkout line buying cereal at Gelson's, and nearly had a panic attack worrying whether I'd closed out of my email on my laptop. And if Tatum, who was sleeping in, would rise and see my glaring infidelity in my emails to Amanda over her breakfast of a hard-boiled egg and cappuccino. I hadn't even meant for it to get this far, to go on for so long. But now we were 11 months, almost a year, deep. When I called her after the hospital, after Joey's broken arm, I'd only meant, theoretically, to meet for a catch-up coffee. The coffee led to drinks, and drinks sometimes led to dinner. Dinner led to emails and texts and late-night phone calls when Joey was asleep. Tatum was working nights. She'd started, theoretically, getting choosier about the projects that wreaked havoc on our life. But America, a gritty drama about the L.A. riots and the ensuing fallout, the script was spectacular. Spencer, my agent, tried to get my name in for a polish. But this was before Tatum signed on and it went to Landon Marks, Hollywood's new it boy who got all the good polishes right now. Kept us on opposite schedules. She'd come home in time to sit with Joey at breakfast, then collapse for the day, before rising to sit with him again for an early dinner before her driver arrived for another day, and night, when we merely passed each other by. Coffee and dinners, and then much more, with Amanda, really weren't all that hard to pull off. Really weren't particularly sneaky, because Tatum wasn't logistically present for me to have to even sneak around. "I'm here," Amanda says again, rustling the standard bedding. I inhale, and my undershirt, sticky with sweat, rises against her palm. At home, when I burst from my nightmares, the bed is most often empty. In fact, just last night, Tatum had taken Joey to Legoland as part of a thank you to the America cast and crew. It had been a long, grueling shoot. She wanted to show her appreciation. I didn't want to go anyway, but she didn't offer. It was exclusively for the staff, the Teamsters, the actors, who deserved some R&R with their kids. she'd said. So instead I emailed Amanda, to ostensibly break up. And then because she was there and loyal and sexy as fuck, and made me feel valued, we ended up in 600 thread count sheets in a room at the Standard. I don't love her. She isn't my wife. But when our legs are intertwined at the bottom of the bed and her hand is across my chest and I am not alone, as I so often am now, and Amanda needs me in ways that Tatum used to but no longer does, I tell myself that I just might. Maybe I love her. Maybe I could. Being valued, being needed, being seen is an easy thing to underestimate. Like air. Like you don't realize that it's necessary to sustain you until it's suddenly gone. Amanda feels like air. Not love, but somehow necessary all the same. Tatum used to say, and I used to believe, that I was the only one who could see her. And I could. I did. I felt the same. She inspired my directorial debut with Romantica. She inspired everything in those early years. Now who knows what we see? It's happened so gradually that I can't even say when things got so blurry. Maybe as she found others who saw her as I did, when it used to be only me. Maybe as I chased success instead of chasing happiness. I don't know. If I did, I probably wouldn't be screwing my ex-girlfriend who plugs the hole in my heart, but probably doesn't fill it.
You okay?
Amanda says, her wide green eyes finding mine. Yes. No. I roll over, stare at the ceiling, then push myself up to my elbows. I should go.
You don't have to.
Not because of you. Yes, because of you, my conscience corrects, but I lean over and peck her nose all the same, move down to graze her lips. I want to work today. The house is quiet. I don't have to be in the writer's room. It's Eric's day there.
I saw last week's episode, she says. I think it was my favorite.
I'm not working on Code Emergency today, but I don't tell her that. I just want to enjoy her adoration. Tatum tries to catch the show from time to time, and God, it's not a requirement to watch a network hospital drama that isn't even all that great. But it would be nice. It would be nice every once in a while to hear her say, last night's episode was my favorite. I stare at Amanda for a beat, then another. I consider saying something cheesy like, what have I done to deserve you, or where have you been all my life? But at the heart of it, neither of those things is true or worth asking. I'm cheating on my beloved wife, so I deserve nothing good, and Amanda hasn't been by my side all my life because our timing wasn't compatible in the way that you need it to be when you're looking for your soulmate. A few weeks ago, in another hotel room, in another hotel bed, I'd asked Amanda once why she chose a residency program over me, back in 2000, back when I thought she'd be mine forever. She considered it for a long time, then said,
I don't think I did it on purpose.
But you had to know that it looked that way, felt that way to me. She nodded.
I suppose, deep down, I wanted someone stronger.
She winced.
That sounds terrible. I don't know what the word is. I guess you were too nice.
I laughed at the irony. That I was now the least nice guy you could think of, screwing another woman instead of his wife. Screwing another woman who he is pretending might be his soulmate, even though he doesn't believe in soulmates. I don't believe in that romantic crap that you pay $12 to see on date night. Life is fucking hard, and life is fucking brutal, and maybe the most we can ask for is someone to get through it with us. So, for now, rather than soulmate, I accept her platitudes and ego-stoking, and I let myself wonder about all of the what-ifs. What if I hadn't dumped her when she moved to Palo Alto? What if I'd stayed on the phone with her on New Year's Eve, rather than run off to meet Tatum? What if my career had exploded and Tatum's hadn't? Would I be happier? Would I be more faithful? I do this partially because, at the heart of it, I miss my wife. And partially because I'm angry with Tatum, too. Angry that Amanda was the one who suggested I mend fences with Eric. Whom last year I told to go fuck himself for insisting that I spend another year pounding out the drivel of a network hospital show, which felt so beneath me. Dude, don't do this, he said. We've been best friends since freshman year. Don't detonate like this. College was a long time ago, I replied. If you lit a match near my mouth, my liquored breath would have caught fire. Fuck this shit. I hate this show. I think you mean that you hate that Leo's gone. He said it kindly, but it was a bruise that shouldn't have been pressed. Fuck you, Eric. You don't know shit about me, about what I want, about what I hate. We met at a whiskey bar downtown, so I stumbled out to the valet, who refused to hand me my keys and instead stuffed me into a cab, where I nearly blew the contents of my stomach before making it home. Eric and I didn't speak for 7 months after that. But he accepted my recent apologies in the way that a best friend does, when he knows you were self-destructing and now you're trying to piece together the wreckage. After Eric, I'd asked Spencer to coffee and told him, with Amanda's praise still massaging my ego, that I was ready to work. Tatum had the luxury of soul nurturing. I just needed to work. Amanda kept saying that to me. You need something that's your own, not hers. Spencer nodded, called the network, and just like that, I was back on code emergency, like the blight of the last 7 months hadn't happened. Spencer made me pay the coffee bill, though, like a warning shot for being such an asshole.
So, what are you running off to work on in your quiet house?
Amanda asks while I dress. She stretches in bed, the duvet resting atop her taut stomach, her breasts exposed and calling me back beside her. Reagan.
Still? I thought you put that aside.
It's going to be my one great thing. The script, the film, that will be my legacy, or at least my new calling card. I heard Tatum's voice, not mine.
Hmm.
Hmm, what? My voice is immediately too brittle.
Don't be irritated with me, she says. I'm not her.
Have it, I say. I'm sorry. It is. Too often now, Tatum and I argue over misunderstandings and nuance. When she says she's being supportive of Code Emergency, and I take it as patronizing. When I tell her that I'm trying to trust Walter, despite his history of relapses and poor judgment, and she accuses me of being disingenuous.
I only meant, because I thought that Reagan was your dad's thing. God, I remember that his office, or library, is that what you guys called his room?
I nod. His library. All alphabetized by author and then title. Leo once got so mad at him that he pulled every single book down into a huge heap in the middle of the rug. I laugh. I think he blamed it on our dog, Bitsy. Amanda smiles, but I'm surprised that she doesn't laugh in the way that Tatum would at the memory of Leo and his impishness. Tatum would howl at the notion that my dad actually pretended to believe it was Bitsy, a 30-pound poodle, his way of acknowledging that he could be a bit of a hard-ass on Leo, on me too. He was tough, my father. But he was also soft, in unexpected ways, unexpected moments.
Well, I remember that your dad had, like, 2 shelves of books on Reagan. Biographies, presidential historical stuff. I don't know.
She cocks her head.
Maybe Reagan is his thing. Maybe it doesn't have to be yours.
I inhale sharply when she says this. That it is so obvious, this script, this thing I've been chasing for half, no, more, of my career. That it was nothing other than textbook psychology. Some kid who was running around trying to impress his dad, whom he could no longer impress. I blink too quickly, wondering if I'm about to have some sort of emotional collapse right here in a standard luxury room with a view of the pool.
Oh, I didn't mean to upset you.
She rises, naked, and moves to hug me. No. No. I wipe my cheeks. You're right. I mean, you're probably right. I don't know how I didn't see this. I unwrap her arms from my neck, push her away too quickly, find that I can't meet her eyes.
Ben.
I should go, really. If it's not going to be Reagan, it should be something else. I have a quiet day. I shouldn't waste it.
I wasn't being critical.
I know. I exhale. I know. I kiss her. But Tatum will be home soon. I need to be there.
Oh,
she says flatly, and tries to wiggle her hands down my pants.
But what if you weren't?
I'll call you later, I say, stepping back and out the door. I don't know if I will call her. I keep meaning to end it, after all. but I promise that I will anyway. Later, when Joey is asleep by 6 o'clock because they went to bed at midnight down at Legoland, and Tatum is reading a script on the couch and I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed and ostensibly rubbing her feet, but she keeps wiggling her toes to remind me to keep going, I say, "Do you think I should keep trying on the Reagan script? It's a test, I know. It's actually more of a trap." She rests the script in her lap, wrinkles her brow. "What brings this on?" "I'm just thinking that maybe if it hasn't come together after all these years, maybe I should give it a rest." She narrows her eyes, assesses, really takes me in.
"I think you underestimate yourself."
I snort. "Well, then this town is right there with me."
"Then..."
It comes out as more of a sigh. "Why didn't you tell me after so many years that this was really my dad's thing? That it was all some Freudian shit that I was chasing, like some textbook Psych 101 bullshit, and that no matter how good the script was, it wouldn't be good enough?" She yanks her head back.
I never said that because I never saw it that way."
"Give me a break, Tatum."
"And even if I had, would you have listened to me? Maybe a while ago, but now? You would have just been pissed, told me I didn't believe in you enough, that I was underestimating you."
I start to say something snide, but stop myself. She's right, of course. I'd have blamed her for not being supportive enough. I remove her feet from my lap, rise and pad to the kitchen before she can read my body language, which is tense, taut, ready for a fight.
"Do you think you should write Reagan? Even if, yeah, maybe it was at first something you wanted to do for your dad?"
She calls to me. I open the fridge door, find nothing of interest, close it too loudly. I turn and find her standing right behind me. Jesus. She rests her script and her bright pink highlighter atop the counter.
"I have a headache. I'm wiped from Legoland, and I don't want to turn this into something it's not."
"Like what?"
"Like a fight, because that's usually where this type of thing goes."
I try to relax my hunched shoulders. I don't want to fight either, and yet I'm on my heels, defensive. Tatum sighs, rubs her eyes. Then?
"But you asked me, do I think you should quit? And you already know my answer."
"You think I shouldn't quit," I say, a little too flatly. "I already know that the great Tatum Connolly never quits anything." She stares at me in a way that makes me feel both transparent and invisible, like she used to back in the early days, like I used to gaze at her, too. Now, rather than making me feel supported, I feel exposed.
"I'm not here to tell you what to do. I just thought I was here to stand beside you. So quit, and see if that makes you happy."
8. Tatum. February 2002. The snow is piling up in Park City, but Ben and I are oblivious. I push him to the ground in the heap outside our hotel and fall on top of him. "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God," I say before I press my lips to his. He laughs so hard he can't keep kissing me, so I roll to his side, sinking into the 8 inches of powder that fell overnight, and flap my arms and legs to create an angel. When he stops laughing, we each tilt our heads together and stare up at the gray sky, the flakes falling on top of our batting eyelashes. It's been months since either of us has been able to entirely forget everything else. The horrors of New York on September 11th, the grief we wear like our own shadows. I'm able to lose myself in my performances. Since my mom died, my work has never been stronger. One professor pulled me aside just before Christmas and told me he'd be happy to recommend me personally to the best agency in the city if I pursue theater. "I don't know what happened between last year and this one, but you are truly extraordinary," he said, examining me like he wondered if I'd been possessed by someone else. "Off the record, you are the shining star of this year's class." I blushed because I still wasn't great at taking compliments, not as me, not Tatum the Great, and then thanked him and told him I'd take him up on that come graduation in June. I didn't say my mom died, and that shifted something in me, unmoored new depths, allowed me to tap into new pain and emotion that might make me a wonderful actress, but made me an open sore of a person. Ben had his own grief, of course,
with his dad. He focused on Romantica, channeled his anguish into turning his once small short film into the best little indie movie that he could, which is why we're in some